The following programming is sponsored by the law firm of Soloff & Zervanus. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soloff & Zervanus show here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a fantastic show. John, how are you, sir?
I'm great, thanks, Joe.
So I'm happy to bring in John's guest for the show, Tom Giordano of Pond La Hockey and Giordano. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Joe. Thanks, John. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
It's a pleasure. So today's broadcast, we're going to be touching on Social Security disability. And, you know, we've had this conversation many times in the past, but, you know, things are updating every day and there's so much to talk about. If you would, real quick, Tom, before we get into that, just remind our listeners, obviously, what you do at the firm and about the firm, in case they haven't driven down 95 or driven up any street in the city of Philadelphia.
Sure. We are a Pennsylvania workers' compensation. We handle nationwide Social Security disability and long-term disability. We're a firm that helps injured workers and disabled individuals throughout the country, essentially, Joe. That's the easiest pitch I can give.
Fantastic. So John has that right off the bat. John's got a question about Social Security disability.
John. It's a general question that would probably be interesting for our listeners. But, you know, people will call us about Social Security, and obviously that's not in our wheelhouse. But, you know, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you pay into the system, you get Social Security disability benefits. And paying in the system means you're employed and they're deducting X, Y, and Z from your paycheck week in, week out. And God forbid you get injured and you can't work anymore. You get workers' comp, but at some point if the workers' comp gets resolved, you can still get your Social Security. And that's considered a Social Security disability benefit. However, if you haven't paid into the system, meaning you haven't been employed long enough to generate anything into the Social Security system,
right,
you're limited to what's called SSI, Social Security, and the I stands for?
It's actually Supplemental Security Income.
Supplemental Security Income. Yeah. So it's really not considered Social Security, correct?
Correct, but they get interchanged all the time.
Right. So, I mean, you'd think I would really have this down by now, but it gets complicated. So if you apply for Social Security benefits, you're just some person on the street, you don't even have an attorney, and you're going through a social worker at the hospital, let's say, and because they do that a lot, these folks at the hospital, and they'll actually help them with their applications. And Social Security will then get the application, and there's a Social Security number on the application, correct?
Correct.
And then that Social Security, the folks at Social Security that are looking at that application, if they approve it, they automatically go into that individual's records, his income and employment history, correct?
Correct.
And they'll determine whether or not you're qualified for SSD or SSI.
Yeah, correct.
So with that Social Security number, they go into the system and they say, okay, we're going to award this person. He's disabled. He or she's disabled. So we're going to award them SSI or SSD. If they paid in the system, they're getting SSD, presumably.
That's correct.
And if they haven't paid in the system, they get SSI.
Not as easy as that, because they have to then, if it's SSI, you have to have certain income and resource limits. So, for example, if you've never paid into the system, so you SSI qualified, but you have X amount of money in the bank, you have more than $5,000 in the bank, you're not going to qualify. It's almost like a welfare. The test for welfare is almost the same for SSI. Okay. So if you haven't paid into the system, let's say you grew up in South Philly like I did, and a lot of people worked under the table, right? If you've never paid into the system, okay, you can't get the SSD like you said. Well, now you can try to get SSI, but if your wife or spouse is working, if you have money in the bank, if you have more than one car, if you have maybe you have a sure house, you're not going to be qualified. It's a little bit more complicated.
And the danger you have is if you just use the example, if you've been getting paid under the table, for example, obviously you're not paying your taxes in most cases. So you think, well, gee, I should be entitled to SSD because I've been working for 30 years, but I've been working under the table. So if you really push that envelope, the IRS will say, well, you want SSD, how come you didn't pay your taxes for 30 years? And then you're going to be looking at an IRS lien, correct?
Exactly. But what you said is so important because people don't realize this. 6.2% of every one of your paychecks, we call them FICA taxes, right? The 6.2 of every paycheck comes out, it goes to the Social Security Trust Fund. Then your employer matches that 6.2. So you're actually getting money in an, it's like a trust fund for you. It's your Social Security account. So when you apply for disability benefits, they already know what you're going to get. And you too can find out what you're going to get by just going on Social Security's website. They used to, if you remember this many years ago, every about 3 months before your birthday, they would send you a two-page document. And it was called a Social Security earnings statement. And it would tell you what you would get at 62, what you would get at 66, and what you would get at 70. It would also tell you what you would get if you're found disabled. They don't do that anymore because it costs too much money to mail. So now you could just go online and get it. So if anybody in the audience is curious, how much would I get in disability if I was found disabled? Just go online, www.ssa.gov, and you can download your earnings statement. It's pretty simple.
How about if you wanted to figure out how much you're going to get when you're 67 versus 70?
It's on there, too. It's the same thing.
It's SSA.gov?
Yep. It's the Social Security Administration's website, and then you download something called your earnings statement.
And it's secure?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I'm sure you got to put all your personal information in there.
They'll ask you 12 questions that only you would know. Did you have a mortgage at this street in the 1980s? Did you have a car pay?
So Big Brother really knows what's happening in your life.
You're not going to get past them with some phony encryption, trust me. Yeah.
So having said that, when it comes to Social Security disability as an attorney, what is your role in the application process?
Yeah, and I think it's important what John said earlier. You could apply on your own. You could apply with the help of a friend. You can apply with the help of a social worker.
I've had friends that tried to do it, and it cost them so much time, it was ridiculous because they did it wrong.
I think that's what the attorney gives you more than anything, gives you peace of mind, especially one a person who specializes in Social Security. I think that would be my number one piece of advice for anybody. You know, if you're dabbling in disability, go to somebody who's done it, whether it's Pond Lee Hockey or another place, but they just make sure they do it all the time. An attorney is going to make sure that the application is put in a way where it is the most proactive, they're advocating for you. What I like about controlling the app from the application process on is I know what's going in. I know that all the doctor's information is correct. I know all the conditions that's impacting the person are in there. You know, you leave out a doctor. Let's just say you're doing it on your own. And you leave out one doctor, Social Security doesn't know you've gone to that doctor. So they'll never get those doctor's records. So that your entire history with that doctor is now not in the record, and they can make a decision and say, well, you're not disabled. Well, maybe you missed the most important doctor's records. You just didn't do it. So peace of mind, hire an attorney, just like in the personal injury. We don't get paid unless you win.
I was going to say, is it a contingency fee?
It's 100% contingent. So we only get paid if you win, and we only get a piece of the back money if they're awarded, because there will be some retroactive benefits.
Yeah, how does that work?
Yeah, it's here's the worst part about the job that I do. It takes a long time. I mean, I can't speed the government up, right? So my clients are going to be waiting anywhere from 6 months to sometimes 18 to 24 months to get an answer. If they're awarded and they've waited that long, they're going to get paid retroactive. They're going to get paid for the time that they waited.
Will they get paid for the time that it was determined that they were disabled?
They could go as far back as a year, depending on when they apply. Yeah, if you applied today, but you've been out of work and disabled for a year, you can actually try to get as far back as a year. And then my fee would be a one-time 25% cut of whatever you get in the back. And then every month you get a Social Security check, that's yours. We don't touch anything in the future. So it's a one-time 25%. And that's capped. That fee's capped.
That's what the federal government allows you to charge.
Federal government only allows us to charge 25%, but no greater than $9,200. And it's whatever's the lesser amount.
And when you talk about the parameters to apply.
Yeah.
Okay. What are the standards for somebody? Talk about the age plateaus.
Sure. So two things. The one thing that I will say, what I like about this area of the law, it's a little bit different than what John practices or my workers' compensation partners. There's no causation. And what I mean by that is the Social Security Administration doesn't matter to them how you got hurt, how you got sick. So it could have been a work injury. It could have been a car accident. It could be a disease. It could be you made a mistake at home when you were mowing the lawn and you ran over your foot. It doesn't matter how it happened. If you have medical conditions that are keeping you from working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week on a consistent basis, you're found disabled. To your question, which is a great one, the older you are, and I don't mean to call people over 50 old, okay? Because I'm getting there. I'm getting real close.
Yeah, look, but I'm also close. I'm also
yeah. You're getting close too, Joe.
Another 15 years, but no.
But they have these rules where if you're 50 and older, it's a little easier for you to win. And what I mean by that is you have to just prove you can't do the work you've done in the past. Whereas if you're 30s and your 20s, you know, 40s.
You can get retrained.
You have to prove you can't do anything in a national economy. It's doable, but it's just a little harder.
And so you mentioned not being able to do the job you've done, okay, for, you know, I guess, your career.
Yeah.
Is that when you're 50? Or in other words, is that the basic standard?
Yeah. So let's use mutual example, ironwork, okay? I've been privileged, thanks to you, to be in front of the iron workers a lot. And these guys are busting their bodies, as you know personally,
sure,
day in and day out. When they turn 50 or older, by that point, they've had degenerative arthritis in their neck, their backs, their knees, everything. I mean, everything's shot, right? All I have to prove for those guys is they can't do that physical job anymore. But if they're a 35-year-old iron worker, now I got to prove they can't say hello to somebody at Walmart, which is a little different. Right?
It's interesting because let's kind of look at both areas, okay? Say medical malpractice, okay? Somebody gets, badly injured or badly affected in something like that. Would that be something, they'd be eligible?
Yeah.
For Social Security?
Yeah.
You're asking?
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, and as John would know, is better than anybody. He's sometimes waiting even longer than I'm waiting to get it, whether to go to trial, settle a case. It's actually a really good play for any personal injury attorney, anybody who's doing that type of work, to send their client to a disability attorney while they're waiting for their trial or their settlement, because I'll get the process moving. It's not going to impact his case, and maybe your client can get disability benefits in addition to a settlement or a verdict in a medical malpractice or personal injury case.
I ask, we've talked about this, in the past. When somebody retires, okay, and typically speaking, you and I have had this conversation, mostly you, with the iron workers retirees, okay, somebody's beat up and they're retiring. Talk about making this a part of, their retirement process, okay, their checklist. Talk about that, if you would.
I will say this to our union friends and even those who are non-union but in physical jobs.
Sure.
If you are retiring and you've done a physical job your whole life, I think the first thing you need to consider is, should I apply for disability? And 99% of the time, the answer is yes. Because, first off, you have nothing to lose. If let's just use the iron worker example. If you're an iron worker and you've worked and you've hit your magic number where you're able to get your pension, right? Well, you can get your pension and apply for disability. And if you get disability, you can get disability in addition to your pension. But if you don't win your disability case, you just keep your pension. Nothing changes. Now, there's no downside to it. So why wouldn't you apply once you retire, assuming you're retiring with some kind of physical or mental impairments? If you're one of the fortunate people who've worked in a physical job and you're retiring 100% pain-free, God bless you. I can't help you in that. And you don't need my help.
Yeah.
Right? But most people aren't. So,
John, talk about when in your world, when you have... So we've talked about the holistic approach, okay? When somebody gets injured on the job, looking at that whole approach, when you're talking about, you have a wide array of personal injury areas, but you do your medical malpractice. Talk about having that on a checklist. In other words, making that an option if somebody has been devastated in any situation. But the fact that, and when you talk about like Tom just said, it takes the medical malpractice cases can take a couple years to settle. Or go to a verdict.
Well,
to talk about that.
I mean, those cases, people will call you and think that those cases are just going to settle. Like, it's I mean, auto cases can settle. I mean, you can settle an auto case without having to file a lawsuit because liability is generally not an issue. And the damages are what they are. And most times they're more likely to settle. And 9 times out of 10, you'd like to get them resolved without having to spend a ton of money, which is what litigation is. It's always going to cost you a lot of money. And you really can't avoid that. Malpractice cases, it's a lot of money times 10 because you have to get a variety of experts depending on the issues. And then you file suit, and then there's going to be a lot of discovery, which means the attorneys representing the hospitals or the doctors are going to want to take depositions. You're going to exchange a lot of paper discovery depending on what the damages are. And, you know, depending on the venue will determine how fast you get yourself to a trial. The goal is during the course of discovery, you create enough risk for the other side that they actually entertain the idea of attempting to settle a case with you. And what I'll tell my clients a lot of times is there's so much risk associated with a malpractice case that you have to think long and hard about settling your case, even if it's not the number that you really thought you might be entitled to.
Could somebody, is it a strategy? Do some people, some attorneys, some defense attorneys choose to risk going to court because their intention is to try to settle the case after it goes to verdict, even if they lose, because they know that it could take forever to on appeal?
So if you try your case.
So you win.
Yeah.
The defense, you know, then is going to appeal potentially.
Not all the time. I mean, has to be an issue in the record that supports an appeal. You can't just appeal a verdict.
John, I'd really like you to just agree with me, and we can move on.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry about that. It's very, you know, when you hear about these cases, well, we're going to appeal. You know, the defense will sometimes appeal a verdict because in Philly especially, there's been some recent appeals because the verdicts were so high that they just thought it was inconsistent with the damages and so forth. And recently there was a verdict that actually was upheld? No, it was actually a judgment. Now, you know, they're going to have another trial, I think, and that's been in the news, at least in the legal journals. It doesn't happen often because I don't think a judge ever wants to stand in the place of a jury and say, hey, "Gee, jury, you were wrong." However, a lot of times during your trial, as an attorney, you have to preserve issues for appeal. So if you think a judge is making evidentiary mistake or an error on some issue of law, you can preserve that so that if you lose your case, you then have standing for appeal. And appeals take an awfully long time, unfortunately. So even if you get a verdict and you believe that the defense has a credible issue to appeal, you know, then you have to go again to your client and say, well, gee, I know you got a verdict for X, but they're offering you Y, and your appeal might not be decided for 18 months. And if you lose, and this is a reasonable issue, and there's some credibility to the defense's argument, you may want to consider taking the offer because the last thing you want to do is try your case again 18 months from now and lose it.
Tom, in your world, okay, especially, we've both talked about this, the first time you apply for Social Security disability, okay, especially, and I've sent some people who've done it on their own, they've not only screwed up the damn application, okay, which put them back 6-8 months, but then, you know, there are certain, it's almost like a protocol for a lot of the time, where the government will automatically, you know, try to smoke you out and shoot it down.
Yep.
Okay. Your success level at the second level is what?
Can I address the first part of that?
Because absolutely, I think not.
It's really important because, and I think this is more of a public service announcement.
Sure.
The likelihood is you're going to get denied on the first try. The way the system is set up, they're denying about 7 out of 10 applications. So 70% of people are getting denied on
after
the first
year,
try.
After a year?
You're waiting about 6 months at that point.
Okay.
But most people, and this is what I think they want, are just quitting. They're throwing their hands up.
They're smoking
them out.
And
I think the stats show 50% of people get denied, don't appeal it. And I you got to appeal everything. You like, unlike what John said earlier in his world, in my world, we get denied, we're appealing, we're filing an appeal, and we're putting you back in front of somebody new. You can't quit. You got to file. You got to appeal. And then the goal is to win at any one of the first three levels. Okay, there's an application. They call it a reconsideration, which is just the second bite of the apple. And then there's a hearing in front of an administrative law judge. To answer your question, I think the national average is 40% of people who go in front of judges win.
40.
Ours is probably double that. Our win rate internally is double that.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So you don't get to the judge until you've appealed it.
Twice.
So, is there a reconsideration?
So that's the second level.
I'm trying to make sure our listeners understand that if you've been denied twice and now it's in front of a judge, it's probably not that surprising that only 40% win in front of a judge because it's already been denied twice. Yeah. So you really need a lawyer at that point to get it. Judges will
always give a continuance so you can find a lawyer. They want you to have a lawyer.
Right.
You know, the people who don't trust lawyers and say, I want to go, that's fine. But 90% of people who...
And you guys are 80%?
About that, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And you know, we understand what you need to win. And you know, so we're definitely picking good cases.
I'm going to ask you a loaded question.
Yeah, sure.
Because I remember back in the day when I used to do workers' comp, you kind of knew which... workers' comp judges were more favorable to workers, and some are more favorable to employers.
Sure.
Do administrative judges have that same reputation?
So not only that, John, because it's the federal government, they have stats.
Oh.
So I can look up any judge's disposition rate. Okay, so I know in any part of the country what judge approves what percentage of their cases. And in Pennsylvania, where we're at currently right now, I think it's a 33% win rate in Pennsylvania.
Well, again, I forgive my questions, but if you're an administrative judge and you're employed by the federal government, maybe I'm just a cynic, but it's kind of like mediators who are getting paid by the medical malpractice insurance industry. You want to be kind to them or you won't be approved as a mediator anymore or an arbitrator. Are federal judges feel, I mean, it's probably not discussed, but do you think that there's some allegiance they have to the government?
Well, I think there's some history here, and the history is that the highest payers historically, when I first started, maybe about 20 years ago, got brought to Capitol Hill to testify in front of a Senate committee on why they were approving so much.
Highest payers meaning highest the administrative
payers,
judges.
The judges who were paying the most cases got brought. Now, the judges who were paying no cases, they didn't get brought. Why haven't you awarded anybody?
So the folks that were awarding money were actually called into Washington
to talk
and explain
about
why they're
And this is something you're paying into your pay, right?
Their award rate was higher than the average judge.
Yeah. Why? That they wanted to know why.
And
now they're unionized. So they've gotten a little tougher, the judges, about allowing that to happen.
Is that the AFG, American Federal Government?
I should know that off the top of my head.
Let me ask you a question. Are there... And it's appalling. That's why you
unbelievable, man. That's really unfortunate.
It's crazy. I know.
That's just unbelievable.
But that's why you need an attorney. And my question is...
So you go back to your bench and you're thinking, they're watching over me.
Yeah.
They're going to call me back if I don't start awarding against people.
Right. They're getting a disincentive.
Talk about the culture in regards to the intake, people through the process. Yeah. Talk about what people can expect.
I think what they can expect is we're gonna ask the questions that you didn't even realize were relevant to a disability application. Like, for example, if you have a really bad back, Joe, and you're calling me because you can't work because of your back, I'm going to focus on your back, but I'm also going to ask you about other things such as, do you have high blood pressure? Do you have diabetes? And people say, well, that doesn't matter. It's my back. Well, no, I throw the entire kitchen sink at the administration, right? So I want to know everything that's bothering you. And I'll rate it from top to bottom, but I'm putting it in the application because it's all important.
Are there conditions? Now, I've heard there is, where it's automatic approval.
Yeah.
Where the waiting period, what is that scenario?
But, I mean, it's those conditions are those are terminal. I mean, it's ALS.
Catastrophically injured people.
It's certain types of cancers that you know that there's no recovery from. I mean, but
ventilator dependent quads.
Yeah, dialysis is one of them as well. Like, I mean, there's a few, but most of it, believe it or not, like even stage four cancers, you have to go through the whole process.
And go ahead.
What's the prerequisites to be an administrative judge in this?
So in the past, it was just. You take a test, now you have to be a lawyer. So that's changed. And I think that's changed in the comp system as well. I think that back in the day, the comp judges didn't have to be lawyers. Now you have to be a lawyer. You have to take a test, but pretty much nothing after that.
A test on Social Security?
I think Social Security. It might even be a civil service test. I'm not quite sure. Yeah.
So we only have a couple minutes left, so I want to roll right through this. Okay, medical documentation.
Yeah.
Okay, you cover, like you said, the gamut. How important is that, and how in depth does it have to be?
You have to be treating. I mean, that's one of the most important things. If somebody says to me, rank what's the most important, you would think I'd say an attorney, right? I actually think going to a doctor is number one. The attorney's number two. Like I need to know that the things that you're complaining about are documented.
Okay, what about mental disabilities?
100%. Again, that has to be documented.
Okay, are they tougher? Like work comp and you know, it's not easy.
It's not easy because, you know, I can show you a spine that has been fused and degenerated for years, right? But I can't. It's really hard for me to show you. There's no test I can give you about, you know, somebody who's depressed.
People with social anxieties, they can't get out their door.
Yeah.
And those folks, some of them are more disabled than people that have physical injuries.
Absolutely.
Tom, if you would just remind our listeners one more time, obviously contact information if they're trying to get in touch.
The easiest way, PondLeeHockey.com, but you can call us 1-800-568-7500, you know, hopefully. If you're on social media, you're seeing some of our posts, which we're proud of. In our
posts. They'll recognize you.
I hope so, man. Drive up and down I-95.
that's right. Listen, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Saul Alvin Servano Show here on WWDB Talk 860. I want to thank our host, John Servanos, and, of course, our guest, Tom Giordano of Pond La Hockey and Giordano. On behalf of John Servanos and Tom Giordano, I'm Joe Doherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.